Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, a program meant to bring you ideas, concepts, guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Oh, and here comes more exciting stuff in 2010. Here we go. You know, for years, people have talked about the heart. They talk about the left brain and the right brain, and they say one part of the brain is really your mind and the other part of the brain is your heart. That's wrong. They're both your brain. Right side, left side, still brain. However, does the heart have a brain? A short while ago, we reported on a stomach having a brain. That your stomach has memories and your stomach has messages and things of its own that function almost automatically. So we have a brain in our stomach. Sometimes it's stupid. And then we have a brain in our heart. Do we have a brain in our heart? Well, wouldn't it make sense that the heart, which people use as such an important signal of love, feelings, I mean, we've made the heart so important, and yet we professionals, we shrinks, we doctors, we walk along and say, ah, you don't mean the heart, you mean the mind. You mean when you say you fall in love and you say, oh, you're in my heart forever, we say, no, you're in his mind forever. You know, and we deny the existence of an intelligence of an organ called the heart. We think of it as a pump. We think it's a stupid thing that just sits there and goes bumpity, 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 and has four rooms, and the blood comes in and the blood goes out, and that's it. And you could put a pacemaker in there and it'll just have an extra air conditioner, you know, or something like that. We don't think of the heart as having any intelligence. Well, unfortunately, we're not getting off that easy. Neurocardiology, that's the new field. Neurocardiology is the ability to image the heart so that you can see what's going on in the heart at different times. And there are different measurements that are now possible of the heart that are showing us that the heart has a major interaction with the brain and with other parts, and that the heart has a mind of its own. Now, of course, you knew that, right? Of course, everybody knew that, right? But we don't believe it. We don't really know it. So neurocardiology brought to me by none other than Teresa Palmer. Teresa Palmer, who's been a friend of BAI and the DeMille Center for years, is also a licensed nurse practitioner and has worked in cardiology for many years. So how exciting. You have Teresa Palmer and you have Sherry Siegel, who's a physician and a neurologist, both whom are interested in giving people straight scoop about medicine. They're on air with us today. This is such an exciting discussion. Welcome both to you, Teresa. Hello, Teresa.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And Sherry, here we are. Teresa, heart in the mind. Mind in the heart. Let's start off with the concept of scared to death. Okay, you think about, can you get scared to death? What does scared to death mean? And I'm going to start with that as a basis because I think it's going to lead us into our discussion.
You can certainly get scared to death. And it's been proven, and in my own practice in hospital-based cardiology, I've seen it at least 5 times. And what happens is someone comes into the hospital, they're admitted to the hospital or through the emergency room, and they look like they've had a heart attack. They have all the signs and symptoms. They have chest pain. They have a lot of fluid in their lungs. They can't breathe. Every indication is telling us that this person is having a major heart attack. We rush them to the ICU, to the CCU. We do a bunch of tests. What happens? All the cardiac tests come back negative.
And the person could be dead.
And the person, if they didn't seek medical care, if they didn't come to the hospital, yes, they could be dead.
So, okay, Well, what does that have to do with the heart? If they didn't have a heart attack, but it looks like a heart attack. They have all the symptoms of a heart attack. And in effect, they did have a heart attack.
In effect, they did
have... But they didn't have a weak heart.
Right. They had a perfectly normal heart, and they had no history that would lead them to be at risk for a heart attack.
So what happens to the human brain? The human brain, the mind perceives the shock, right?
Yes.
And then the mind sends a message to the heart.
It sends the message to the heart, and it tells the heart that it's under stress, and it releases adrenaline.
Oh, it tells the heart, give me some of that adrenaline.
It says, well, give me some of that adrenaline, because in small doses, adrenaline can help boost a heart that may be a little weak.
And a heart that has to be fit for battle. Let's say you get scared.
Right.
So the heart has to be fit for this battle. You say to the heart, give us some adrenaline. But doesn't the heart get the adrenaline from the brain?
The heart does get the adrenaline from the brain through the nervous system, because the heart and the brain have this connection through the spinal cord.
So you think the brain could say, give me some adrenaline, but if the heart didn't feel like doing it, it wouldn't get it.
Well, what happens is the heart gets too much of it, and the heart's way of saying, I don't want any more, is to stop beating.
All right. So your kid makes you angry, right? And your kid does something to you that, you know, comes home late and is pregnant, and he's only 11. No. For some reason, you get upset with your kid. And your brain gets murderous, and you go into a kind of a rage. And the adrenaline starts pumping, because now your 11-year-old is your enemy. And you say to yourself, hey, cool down. Stop the adrenaline. And so you go to your mind, and your mind tells your heart, relax. And you calm down, and you don't hit your kid. Or you may have a heart attack before you ever get to hitting your kid. One or the other. So the adrenaline is working at the command of the mind, but it is working on the organ of the heart.
Exactly.
Well then, could you account, and you've seen this happen.
I've seen normal, healthy, I've seen four women and one man that have come in with no cardiac history, no heart history whatsoever. Human beings that haven't even been to a hospital or been to a doctor for any illness, and they've experienced significant negative emotions or losses. One woman I saw had lost her job, had lost her mother, and then had broken up her engagement for marriage all in a 6-month period. And within that time, because she was under so much stress, the adrenaline kept being secreted until finally the heart said, enough, I can't take anymore. And the heart's reaction is to shut down. And this woman literally walked into the emergency room and collapsed.
You know, on another level, as you think about it, if you had that many losses, maybe you had some way of doing that yourself to yourself. Maybe that's your way of committing suicide.
It could be. That's one of the speculations is that if we have a lot of stressors and we're under a lot of pressure, this constant pressure, that if we don't do something to help manage that, it's not to say that you can't have stress in your life. We all have stress, and that's not going to go away. But how we manage it and how we recognize it a lot of times could make the difference. And it almost seems like some people want to go the other route of kind of enough is enough, I can't handle this anymore. And that would be one way of doing it.
Huh. So people who accumulate stress may be attempting suicide. Interesting, huh? Maybe they just feel life is too much. And so they get more and more stressful, hoping that they're going to get this thing. And I'm going to give this a word that used to be used with no implications to current beliefs. But it used to be called voodoo death. Wasn't it? Was that what voodoo death was?
Yes. A person was frightened, and they got frightened to the point where these chemicals got secreted in their body and they died. And
it's like somebody was watching Michael Jackson's Thriller video and then boom, right? Voodoo death, they used to call it. But now we're beginning to see it because we have imaging. Neurocardiology, which means the ability to see the heart and to see the heart in functions in ways that we could never see before, has become a new field. new. I mean, it's been around, but it's never been as validated as now. So now we have neuropsychology, which is studying the brain, neuropsychiatry, and now we have neurocardiology, which is beginning to teach us that the heart and the mind are not separate, and that the work is not all in the mind, but it is not commanded by the mind, and the heart is not just a pump. Let me take this just a step further, which I think would be interesting to people. People have always talked about love as being a phenomena of the heart. Phenomenon of the heart. Right? It's my heart. My heart quells. My heart swells. My heart bells. My heart tells. All things of the heart. And we say, no, it's not your heart. It's your mind or it's your genitals talking. It's one or the other. We have not done neurogenitalia yet. We'll get to it. We'll get to it. You'll see any day now they're going to have you, you know, studying your genitals with imaging and seeing where the blood flows. And it's going to happen. Those guys, they're wild, right? They're wild. They got the machines now, you know? Or just hold it right there, mister. Right? Let's see if, oh, there goes a little blood flow. We know what you're thinking. All right. But now we're doing neurocardiology. So now a person's experience of love is they talk about their heart, and yet we say, now it's not there. But you came up with some interesting information before about serotonin. Serotonin, which is we've talked about it enough. You got to have it to feel good, right? Sherry? Where are we without serotonin? Mm-hmm.
It was the neurochemical of the 90s, and certainly an important chemical in helping to make us feel comfortably happy, not excessively happy, but just feel normally.
To be somewhere in balance, to be somewhere calm, you got to have serotonin, right? All the antidepressants
exactly
are based around picking up your serotonin.
Right,
because when your serotonin drops on the floor, somebody's got to get a mop and pick it up and wring it back into what we thought was your mind, but it's not that. No, serotonin is stored in different places. And where is it stored?
One of the places is in the heart, in the cells in the heart. It's also stored in the stomach. And one of the things with serotonin is you have to get the serotonin from those cells to the brain, where it actually gets released and starts to work. And that's what antidepressants do, is they raise the serotonin levels. They get serotonin able to be moved and transported to the brain, where it reacts and works.
And it helps the serotonin that's already in the brain. They work in concert?
Yes, yes.
Well, let me ask you something, Sherry Siegel, MD. Serotonin in the stomach. But I mean, if you eat the right food, you feel right? Well, do you think there's such a trigger? Do you think we have serotonin in our stomach so that if we eat mashed potatoes with cheese and butter, somehow it sends a signal down there, which sends a signal up to the brain, which sends a signal down to the heart, which releases serotonin somewhere in the stomach?
Great. That's an interesting scenario. And there's no doubt that there are things that we can eat that are precursors to chemicals that we make in our brain and in our bodies.
Like chocolate.
Chocolate or tryptophan, things that contain tryptophan, a precursor to some of the other serotonin and some of the other chemicals in our body. But I don't think it's such a direct connection.
Yeah, I didn't think so, too.
But I think what we were talking about...
Donuts. I think donuts.
Donuts. Now, that is a neurochemical.
Donuts are directed because you can tell the policemen. They know what they're doing. Yeah. The policemen, they sit around. They're so filled with your testosterone. They're ready. They're on fire. They're going to shoot somebody if they look the wrong way. And they eat donuts. And the donuts release serotonin. And they sit in the car eating donuts. And they'd rather eat donuts than chase somebody and shoot them.
That's an interesting theory.
That's the theory of why there are donuts. That's why policemen eat donuts, right? Serotonin comes from donuts. All right, let's go back to neurocardiology. So neurocardiology has many dimensions. But Sherry, you know, you and I first really started exploring this week. And tell me how it's affected you as a neurologist. when you hear neurocardiology and you say, what? Right?
It's true. You know, there's no question that the brain is connected and has connections to all our different organs. But in my training, and I think as a physician, I think of the heart as a pump and the brain as the boss. It tells the body what to do. So it's a relatively new concept.
But you do believe that the stomach is not just a pump?
I think that both organs, the heart, the stomach, other organs in our bodies, think, but on a very basic level.
Sure.
Maybe the way our brainstem does.
They think in their own neighborhood, right? They don't think outside the neighborhood. They may not think of the whole thing.
I think that's a great way to put it. They think about what's important to them. And thinking, I think all of us as humans, we think of thinking as complex, you know, one thought interacting with another, and what about that relationship, and what about many years ago? Those are more cortical thoughts. They're more new brain thoughts.
That's what we've suspected. Now, what if it's true that the stomach has the ability to think in terms of how do we keep this generation of people alive by commanding enough food so that we could get fat storage so that when the cold comes, we're going to get through the cold? And that may not be brain. That may be all stomach. See, there's wisdom in different parts, and we're beginning to learn there's activity in different organs of the body that are giving us some smarts here.
You know, you're making me think of the thyroid, which is a gland in the neck. We all have a thyroid. But in order for the thyroid to release its hormones into the bloodstream, the brain has to be activated. And so the brain and the thyroid interact all the time via the chemicals that travel in the bloodstream.
Right, and the thyroid is not just a pump.
That's exactly right.
The thyroid is, well, tell me how the thyroid thinks.
Well, it responds to either too much or too little of a stimulating hormone that comes from the brain.
What's Hashimoto?
That is a disorder of the thyroid.
Which is either too much or too little.
Right. I'd have to brush up on my thyroid disease to remember too much about that. But there's no question the healthy thyroid works by responding to stimulating hormones that come from the brain. And then the thyroid itself puts out chemicals which circulate in the blood. And then the brain gets the message, oh, we don't have to keep stimulating the thyroid. Enough thyroid hormone is being put into the bloodstream.
Okay, so it's not so dramatic for us to say that there are interactions of different parts of the body, but this cardiology idea, this idea that there is stuff that's going on in the heart. Go ahead, you take it from here, Teresa. What do you speculate and what do you see?
Some of the speculation is working in cardiology and working around the heart. I see the heart as the master. To me, the heart controls everything, because without your heart, there's a direct relationship between the heart and the kidneys. When certain things go on with the heart, it could affect the kidneys. When certain conditions go on with the kidneys, it affects the way the heart functions. The same thing with the lungs. There's conditions where people get fluid that back up from their heart into their lungs. And then it becomes not only a condition of the heart, but a condition of the lungs. And I see as the heart as the source where all this occurs. You can't live without your heart. They do transplant hearts, but you have to have a heart in order to live.
But that could be just the pump. See, now I think what Sherry's point is that it's just a pump. We're making a different case. Neurocardiology, according to you, has many dimensions, but it be conceptualized as divided into three major categories. The heart's effect on the brain, category one. The brain's effect on the heart. And then the third one is neurocardiac syndromes. The present review deals with the nervous system's capacity to injure the heart. So could you talk to me a little about this, Sherry? I remember at the beginning in 1942, at the culmination of his great career as professor of physiology at Harvard Medical School.
Are you talking about Walter Cannon?
Yeah.
What he discovered about the syndrome you mentioned before.
Yeah, the voodoo death.
Well, we now call that the broken heart syndrome. That was really what we were talking about, what we described before, where someone believed that a spell was being put upon him or her, and the fright that that caused was so intense that it caused a sudden stop of the heart. Very similar to what you described before, Teresa, about someone who had a great fright and where the heart actually stopped. And these people, this would result in the death of somebody, really induced by a wizard, or it wouldn't have to be something in front of them, but as long as they believed that they were not able, that they were unable to stop it and had no power over stopping this from happening, they would die.
I agree with that. And I think the heart, when we look at the heart now, I think of it in terms also of power. That I think of the heart as empowering us. That back in 1942, when people believed that this outside force came and did this to them, they felt powerless. They could do nothing. They stopped. Their heart stopped. Now I think what we can do is we can look at things, and we could look at when we're under stress. We could look at things that bother us. We could start to help ourselves more. And to me, that's very empowering. And from a personal perspective, I think that's something from the medical profession that we haven't always given that to people. When people come, a lot of times, people give away a lot of their power to healthcare professionals. They either want to be fixed or something is wrong, and they kind of step aside and they say, you're the expert on this, you fix me. And they kind of leave themselves out of it. And I think we have to get more into our whole total self. And
you know, in a way, from what you're saying, going to a cardiologist could be the most stupid thing you could do. It could just be downright stupid if your cardiologist does not think of your whole body. And I've been to cardiologists who just, you know, these little guys, they get they're not little in stature, but they have a small office, usually with a small waiting room. Usually they just take you according to your medical plan. And you go in and they do tests on your heart, you know. They have the nurses run by and do your EKG and stuff like that. And they read the piece of paper, and they don't even look at you. I mean, they may look at you, they may press and see if you got any blood and, you know, fluids in your legs and stuff like that. But they don't relate to the rest of you. They don't even ask you how you're feeling. They don't ask you, how's your wife? You know, how's your life? They're just relating to the physical thing, the one organ, the heart. And specialists get really stuck in that. I'm sure that's what you found, Sherry, as a physician among other physicians, right?
You know, I think that that's true. And I think many of us went to medical school hoping that we could help the whole person and heal a whole person. But because of the direction that medicine's taken, we've been compartmentalized so that cardiologists look at EKGs and cardiac enzymes, and neurologists look at scans and EEGs. And each of the subspecialists, I think you're absolutely right. So we, in some ways, depend upon nurse practitioners and other primary care practitioners to put the story together. But I think now that we change doctors so often, an even better source is to empower the patient or the person who's interested in their health, so that they can learn to put the whole story together. We want to empower them. I think that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, you want to empower them, but not many people do. We want to give them medication because we get paid to give them medication. I mean, the real empowering is find out what's wrong with you, really.
Right, what's deeply inside?
Yeah, what's happening?
What is happening in your life, not just in your body? Because it's how that all works together, the biopsychosocial. It's what we did learn in school, all of us. But we haven't been offered a chance to enact that in our practices these days, where we're constrained a lot. But I think things are turning. They're turning a corner because people want to become empowered. Then they really want to learn, well, what is this cardiac thing? What is this medicine I'm taking? Why are you prescribing it? And I believe we owe them that information.
This is Armand DeMille. I'm with Teresa Palmer and Sherry Siegel. We're talking about the brain and the heart, that the heart has a brain. Teresa, what other signs do we have that the brain, besides being able to secrete, release, and hold serotonin on command, demand, or suspicion, which it might do, what else gives you a suspicion that the heart may have a mind of its own?
Well, we know that the heart has a nervous system. It's composed of cells.
Well, everything has a nervous system.
Everything in the
body,
has a nervous
right?
system. Every part of our body has cells. The heart cells have what they call a junction gap where the cells could communicate directly with each other.
That's the ganglia?
It has a section called the ganglia, which in the brain is responsible for short and long-term memory. So there is this speculation that because the heart also has this set of ganglia, these cells together, that the heart itself could remember. Hmm. So that when you were a child and you did something and your mother yelled at you, maybe as an adult when you're put into a similar situation, your heart then remembers that scenario and you feel that you're going to get yelled at, whether it be by your mother or by somebody else. And this in turn creates your feeling.
I've seen enough people who get relaxed to a certain point where suddenly they feel panic, because I think of that just very thing, that they've opened the doors to memories of the heart. Memories of the heart. Can the heart remember? You know, when we did our studies on memories, we didn't even figure it for a moment. You know, Sherry, we did, it's all up there in the brain.
The brain.
That's all the place it could take place.
And now we know that there's cellular memory, that not only the heart cells have memory, but other cells in the body also have memory.
Which cells in the body?
Every cell potentially has memory. But again, it's not the complex memory that we think of when we look back at our childhood, for example, which is very complex. When we think about heart memory, I think we're thinking about something, we're thinking, almost in quotes, in a more primal level. If you think about the heart, you brought some information in saying that the heart has 40,000 neurons, which are nerve cells. That was a surprise to me. But then when I think about it, or when I compare it to the brain, which has 100 billion neurons, and in addition, many, even more glial cells, which now are thought to have activity that we didn't know they had before. So the complexity of the thought or the memory is different for the organs than it is for the brain. But I suspect that they work in concert.
They work in concert. And one of the things with the heart is it's reactive. So its memory is more reactive and remembering a specific situation, a feeling associated with something. So that if it was a good feeling or if it was a not so good feeling.
One of the things we learned about memory recently is that you remember as much as the last time you remembered it. Remember this,
yes,
very interesting
do.
Theory? So therefore, anniversaries could be really important because you call up the memory of the memory, you know what I mean? And the whole idea of why we have anniversaries is to renew the memory of the love or the memory of the bond. Maybe that's why we have birthdays, you know? Maybe it's the whole idea of why we have these reminders that we seem to be so taken with, that we like to do, you know, and even I guess even the holidays. Just a memory somewhere, time to give, a time to receive, a time to renew. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about fascinating stuff here. Be sure to stick with us. We will be back with you after a little music and after our break. We'll be right back.
You and I were never meant to be. I don't believe in no. And even if it's so, I'm falling anyway. No matter what they say, a part of me is taking me by the hand. The world can see, still they can understand. Why can't they understand? My heart has a mind of its own. Right. yours is true. I'll follow it wherever it goes, anywhere it leads me to. My heart has a mind, mind of its own. Maybe this will last a thousand years. Ain't nobody knows, and even if they did, it wouldn't matter now. I love you anyhow. A part of me is taking me by.
One of those things, you know, how many times has someone come up to you and said, I met this man, I've fallen in love, I met this man and I know he's no good for me, but I'm going to see him anyway. And they ask you for advice. Now what's happening is their heart has gotten locked. Now maybe other parts of their bodies have gotten locked. Maybe they got locked sexually, maybe they've gotten locked passionately, maybe they've gotten other kinds of feelings as well. But then they ask you for advice, and what do? You give them mind advice. I knew this one lady. She was an aunt to somebody. But whenever you would talk to her, you could talk to her about the craziest stuff, and she would never advise you what to do. Advice is so cheap when it does not consider that the heart may be the thing in control here. So this is Armand DeMille with you with Sherry Siegel and Teresa Palmer. And Teresa was brought to us the idea of the interconnected, independent heart and brain. The brain is in the heart. Is it really true? Is there a heart brain? And this is all evidenced by neurocardiology, a new field of study. So Teresa, tell us a little more about this.
Okay, some of the ways that there's four ways that the heart does communicate with the brain. There's a way, the nerve impulse transmission, And then there's biochemically, which is the hormones and the neurotransmitters. And these are things like adrenaline, norepinephrine, cortisol, all these secretions. Then there's biophysically, which are pressure waves. And the pressure waves actually have to do with the beat of the heart. And there have been some studies where the heart and the brain actually synchronize with the rhythm, that the brain waves actually start to synchronize with the way that the heart is beating. And when the heart beats regularly, it's a two-beat, it's a lub-dub, that the brain waves synchronize with that. And that the brain then functions at its optimal level. And then the last way is the electromagnetic field. And this is an area that has so much speculation right now, because we know that the heart has an electromagnetic field. We know that it has a positive and a negative energy. We just don't know how far this energy goes outside the body. At first, we thought it stayed just within the heart and within the cells and within the skin. Now, we're speculating that it goes much further than that. And they're actually, if you want to get really more radical about it, some are theorizing that our interconnectedness and our connections with other people and our communications are coming through this electromagnetic field. And one of the things is you could be brain dead or comatose. Somebody could speak to you, somebody could touch you. And when they do that, your heart is receiving this through the electromagnetic field. And it actually, there's energy healing, there's all kinds of things that are speculative that go along with this that have no real proven research, but we're starting to look in that direction. And I find that so exciting.
And if you think about the relaxation response that Herb Benson, a cardiologist, talked about. He talked about how our brains affect our hearts in tremendous ways. And when we can learn to reduce stress, that our hearts are significantly improved, and there are diminished numbers of heart attacks and heart disorders. So there's no question that there's a relationship between the two. How much of a relationship? That's the question, is how is it related, and how do these different things work? I think it's really an interesting question.
It is, and what we do know is that the heart actually sends messages to the brain. So what happens is when you get a feeling, you get a feeling, it comes into the heart, and you say either this is a good or a bad, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm stressed about it. Okay, the cells then in the heart go up the spinal cord and send this message to the brain. When it sends the message to the brain that says, I'm unhappy, I'm under stress, this isn't good, the brain tries to fix that, and the brain sends out adrenaline, which kind of revs up the system and gets you ready for the fight or flight. And it makes you ready for battle. So the brain is giving the information back to the heart and saying, uh-oh, we're having a problem. Let's get ready for battle. The opposite is when the heart senses an emotion that is calming, that is relaxing. And that's what they do with the relaxation response. The message that goes to the brain from the spinal cord is one of calmness. Everything is okay. The body is in balance, or what scientists call equilibrium. And when that happens, the brain responds by sending out dopamine, which is a pleasure chemical. And that relaxes the body and it makes you feel good.
You know, and when you talk about the electromagnetic field, really our nervous system also works on two mechanisms. One is through chemicals, the release of chemicals, and the other is through electricity. And so without electricity in our bodies, our nervous systems couldn't work. So electricity in the body and the electromagnetic field that is functioning inside of us and maybe even outside of us is vital to the function of the nervous system.
And then the question comes that to change our mind, do we first have to change our heart? Do we have to change our feeling? How do we change our perception? My understanding with the brain is that the brain almost acts like a camera, and it almost photographs a memory or situation, and then it responds the next time the same way. So if we want to change things now, do we have to start with our heart? And do we really have to change that perception and that feeling within our heart?
The real question is, can you exclude your heart and make changes? And there's where the real doubt is. Can you exclude your heart, which so many people try to do? They try to just make mental changes. So and they don't want to consider the feelings behind it.
Just focusing on the heart, on the brain, and without
regard to the
heart.
Problem with most psychoanalysis. The problem with most behavior modification and stuff like that is it's going in one level only, you know? It's saying, let's go in with the brain. The brain could fix anything. Let's ignore the heart. We don't have to pay attention to that. It's just this nuisance of an organ.
Right. And even isn't Gestalt therapy based upon what we feel in our bodies and what's going on in our bodies?
It is. Gestalt therapy is the interaction between your body and your mind, specifically. It was based on that, trying to find that dialogue. What about Eastern? Now, you know, this is Western medicine.
Right.
What have they done in Eastern tradition in approaching the same conundrum?
Eastern tradition is very interesting because if you look at it, everything from Chinese medicine to Buddhism, everything starts with the heart. So if you go to an Eastern practitioner for any type of medical, or they call it really health care or wellness care, they first start out with, how are you? How are you feeling? And they start to ask you questions about what you're doing, how you're feeling about things, if you're happy, if you're sad. They're looking at the heart as the main seat of our consciousness and of our feelings, and that if the heart is out of balance, then the rest of the body, it causes illness and or disease. And if you look at the word disease, it just means dis-ease. It means that the body is not at ease.
And so how do they approach it once they, when an Eastern practitioner asks you those questions?
Oh, I feel terrible. My wife just left me and I've got no money and I lost my job. They give you acupuncture. Where's the approach?
The approach is that they start to talk to you about this and they want to know what you're feeling. How do you feel about this? And then they ask you where you feel it. Do you feel it in terms of pain in your heart? Because some people experience a heaviness in their heart when they're sad. They'll describe it as, I have this heavy feeling in my heart. Some people feel things in the pit of their stomach. So what the Eastern practitioner does is it looks at your feelings and finds a place in the body where those feelings reside. And oftentimes they're finding it in the heart. The people are saying, I have a heaviness in my heart. My heart hurts. My heart is breaking because I lost my job or I lost my
spouse. But most Eastern practitioners use manipulation as a treatment.
Yes.
They don't use let's talk about it. They use...
Right. Right. What they do is there's nerve pathways that go from organ to organ. It goes all throughout the body and the nervous system. And what they do is a lot of times with acupuncture is they tap into what they believe is the energy source.
So whether that works any better than Western medicine, we're not really sure, except that they look a lot healthier than we do. There is one question, though, that comes in here, which is if you look at the perception of the chakras, you know, and you think about that, when we think about, you know, the chakras, which are, give us a definition.
Okay, the chakras are wheels of energy. And they're not really proven in the physical body to exist. In Eastern tradition, they call this the wheels of energy. And they do correspond to major organs. There's one at the base of the spine. There's one at the pelvic organs, at the stomach, at the heart level, at the throat level, at the pineal gland and the endocrine system and the top of the head. So they do, the heart chakra is considered the bridge.
And they believe, though.
They believe
that the first three chakras, money, sex, and power,
are more primitive.
Those are the lower ones. Those are somewhere, guess where.
Right, those are.
Around the genitals, right?
Right.
And so those are your money, sex, and power ones, right. And that the goal in life is to head up towards the more mental, more clear, more free, more spiritual, higher chakras.
Right, the more what they call intellectual thinking.
And what in between the two?
In between the two is the heart chakra, and that's the bridge that you have to get. You have to open, or you have to be connected to that heart chakra in order to get to the higher intelligence. Otherwise,
now, to you,
you're stuck in survival.
You, a scientist, who is talking about this, as I know you to be, and you're saying, you know, you're really convinced, Teresa Palmer, that if people are trying to take care of themselves, and I know you do medical consulting about people who have got physical problems and they want to talk to you, but you're convinced unless you deal with the emotions, which you consider to reside mostly around the heart, that a person's health is kind of always going to be at odds.
I totally believe this because I believe that disease and physical illness comes from our emotional state of being, that we, how we think, how we feel, and actually who we are, the type of things that we do on a day-to-day basis affect our health. It's been proven over and over again that things that when you volunteer, that when you give, instead of constantly taking, that it boosts the immune system. And they've shown this even in the elderly people, that they've had less illness as far as the respiratory system, that they have higher immunity, that they have better health. So to me, it stands to reason that if you could get into feelings and you could get into how people are and how they act and what kind of people we are on a day-to-day basis, that if we could work on that and look at ourselves, that we have a better chance of having better health and living a longer life.
It's true. And if you look at the individual organs, if we go from doctor to doctor, trying to find out what the problem is, and we have heart tests, and we have brain tests, and we have kidney and lung tests, we're missing a very important glue that holds it all together. And really, that is our emotional substrate and our social substrate. It's a psychosocial substrate, because without that, if your liver's working, well, mazel tov. If your heart's working, great. But if you don't have health in the psychosocial realm, then really it takes a toll, because you're like the likelihood that you'll eat in a healthful manner, that you'll exercise, that you'll communicate with other people in a healthful way, diminishes significantly. So without approaching the social part of our lives and the emotional part of our lives, we are ignoring an important part of our health.
We are. That we also need other people. We need relationships. And all this interplays in how our health is. That they found that if people are isolated, that their health declines. That they don't live as long as people that have an that are connected to other people and have a support system.
And it goes back to the mind, the brain, and the heart. Without the connection between the two organs, one cannot survive.
Yeah.
A heart can't survive without a brain, and a brain can't survive without a heart.
No. It shows that they're interconnected with each other. They're not independent. They have to work not only together, but they also have to work in sync and in rhythm with each other.
Right. And I have to just back up one small bit to something I just said. A heart can pump when the brain is not functioning. And for some poor individuals who have suffered significant brain injury and maybe what's considered brain dead, their hearts still pump and their kidneys pump and do the things they need to do. But they don't remain healthy for a long period of time. People in a vegetative state, or that's an old name for it, but people understand where the brain can't think very much. Sometimes the heart can function for a long time, but the health of the organism is affected because the brain's sick.
Right.
Or Absolutely. Not functioning.
So I guess we're making a case for holism, whatever that is, right?
Absolutely.
That we're saying it's just kind of silly to do it any other way around. Vitamins aren't enough, you know? Neurotransmitters aren't enough. Thinking about it isn't enough. It all makes sense. If it all makes sense and it doesn't work, what goes wrong? How many runners have you heard about, people who are in the fit of the prime of life, who just zoop, stop right there? Because when the heart's not working, you know, it seems that nothing else is.
I think it's important, though, to remember that sometimes our body does have a quirk and something can go wrong, even when our mind and our emotions are in order.
Sure.
And the reason I'm saying that is that some people then think, well, something's wrong with me physically. I'm ill. I must be doing this to myself because of my social situation and my emotions aren't good. Something I'm doing wrong. Very often our bodies come up with illness that's really out of our ability to control it. So
that's
it's not always our fault.
That's why we invented God. Mm-hmm. You see, it's God's fault. God wants me to be this way because we can't figure it out sometimes. Yeah, but sometimes you are being challenged, you know, and you're being challenged, and the challenge itself becomes your wisdom. See, even when there is no cause or no reason, the challenge takes you over the next step.
It's wisdom, you know? We don't really look for, but it finds us.
It does find us. So I guess we have to do a little more research on this. I guess we have to go digging this up more and more. You two, as I know it, are currently consulting with people both on medical well-being. And that means that if you go to a doctor who is testing you for something and then sells you a pill immediately afterwards that he happens to sell in his office, I always find that suspicious. You know what I mean? He says, yeah, you got your serotonin's too low. Take these pills. I sell you these. Or if you go to a specialist who's a surgeon and he says, oh, yeah, he looks at your foot. Yep, you got to have foot surgery. I find it suspicious. Sometimes you just want to be able to have somebody you could consult with medically that is not invested, that all they want to do is see you, get paid for their time, but not even have you come back. It's just mainly they want to see you, and maybe you could even hire them as an advocate when necessary. That's what I think the two of you are doing now. You know, you're forming a new branch of healing, I think, which is consulting and not consulting with an axe to grind. You're not nutritionists who are telling people to do all nutrition. You're not physicians who are telling people to do all medicine. You are physicians and nurse, and you are saying that you're there for people, and this is what you love to do. Show people alternatives, help them with their information. Am I doing this accurately?
Very accurately.
Mm-hmm. What did you call it? What was the term you gave it?
Personal medical consulting.
PMCs.
And right. It gives people, it empowers people by giving them information about what's going on in their bodies and helping them get the big picture, understanding their own health goals.
Yeah, and I think the more information that you have, the better you're able to make choices. And your choice may be to go to somebody and get a pill because you may feel that you want to take a faster way to do something, or you may choose to do something a little bit different. But either way, you're putting power back to the people, and that's so important, especially now with healthcare. And when you look at the rising costs of everything, and you look at healthcare and all the changes that are going on, we don't even know some of the changes that are coming with healthcare. So to me, it makes so much sense, and it's just so important for people to be empowered and to be able to look at things and say, this is how I want to proceed, or I have all this information and I have two or three choices, and now I'm going to make the choice that's best for me, rather than having somebody else just say to them, this is what you should do.
Like in the old days, paternalistic right. Medicine.
This is Armand DeMille with you with a positive mind. We'll end this with the Catfish Blues because it's so relevant. And be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Thank you very much, Teresa Palmer, Sherry Siegel.
Baby, I wish I was a catfish.
Revolution Books will host an evening entitled...